But I have the pleasure today of introducing Kate Acoff, who is the chair of the Albemarle School Board. She's also the chair of the University of Physicians Group here at the University of Virginia and the chair of the Mental Health America Charlottesville Albemarle and the steering committee of the Community Mental Health and Wellness Coalition. She was elected in 2013 to represent the Jack Jewett Magisterial District. Kate is previously a consultant to the Virginia Supreme Court Commission on Mental Health Care Reform, an adjunct assistant professor at Emory University School of Public Health, vice president of the Policy of Education with the National Public Health and Hospital Institute. Ms. Acoff is the graduate of the University of Tulsa. She received a master's in microbiology and immunology from the University of Colorado, a PhD and a master's of public health in public health and public policy and management from Johns Hopkins School of Public Health, and she earned a JD from Georgetown University. Kate, the floor is yours to talk about Albemarle County Schools. Thank you.
Thank you, Rich. I clearly like education because I've gone to school for far too long. My dad was a teacher. I couldn't help myself. But thank you, Rich, for inviting me and actually inviting me twice because I had to miss the November session, and I do apologize for that, but I had a family health issue that I had to jet off to Iowa to handle. First, I want to thank Rich for his invitation and for me, talking about our schools is a great way to start the new year. I've known Rich for 8 years through our joint work with a UVA board, and I know he was also a valued financial advisor, a valued advisor to our past superintendent as a member of her financial advisory board. Rich served ACPS in a very difficult time when it was struggling with the draconian impact of the Great Recession slump in public education funds. Although student enrollment didn't pause, it continued to perk up. And since the Great Recession, just thinking about it, we've added about 1,000 students, which is about the size of Albemarle High School, but we haven't built a new school, which is one of the reasons why we have ongoing trailers and capacity issues, which we'll talk about later. Many painful cuts had to be made, but they were done in ways to the best that we could protect the classroom. Unlike many school divisions, ACPS kept class sizes small, kept arts and music curriculum in place, and continued to develop its STEM academies. However, the cumulative impact of state cuts to public education, amounting to between $60 and $80 million, was really cost-shifting to local government. And I'm really grateful for the community for continuing to show robust support for our schools. But that cumulative impact has had a particularly devastating impact on our capital investment, and I'll talk about that a bit more later. First, some basic facts about our school, just to get you oriented. First of all, has any of you worked in the school or gone to Albemarle County Schools or had kids that attended Albemarle County Schools? Well, then maybe it's changed a bit since then. We operate 25 schools, and we have close to 14,000 students. We have 15 elementary schools, 6 middle schools, 4 high schools. I had someone just asking me, but we have 3 STEM academies at 3 of our traditional high schools. We have about 2,500 employees. After the university, one of the bigger employers in the community. About 1,300. Over 1,300 are teachers, and that teachers are include not only classroom teachers, but speech pathologists, school counselors, instructional coaches, and librarians, and we have about 1,260 classified staff, which is everyone from building maintenance to our transportation, custodians, our information technology folks, and others. We're a big county. We're 726 square miles, so one of our big expenditures is transportation. Our buses cover over 14,384 miles every single day. We are the largest transportation enterprise in Central Virginia. We have about 200 buses, about 165 to 70 are in service every single day. And so obviously keeping those buses running well, having a very efficient fuel program, having an efficient nationally recognized GPS system for routing our buses all makes that work. But in comparing per student expenditures, you might want to think about the big chunk that transportation takes compared with our neighbor, Charlottesville, which is 10 square miles. I mean, they don't have a bus fleet. We do, and that's a critical part of our enterprise of educating our students. Going to the niche slide, we do a really good job. Overall, if you look at our data, it's something that this community can be very proud of. Based on the niche, if you're not familiar with it, is a national organization that rates schools, school divisions, colleges, and they look at academic performance, they look at the qualifications of their teachers, they look at absenteeism and discipline and school climate. And with these metrics, Albemarle County Public Schools ranked number 3 in the state of Virginia, and that's out of 131 school divisions, top 2%, 2.5%. And if you look also nationally, we're in the top couple of percent of school divisions. So that's a lot to be proud of. So why am I here? Why am I talking about the schools? Our overarching student-centered goal is all Albemarle County Public School students will graduate having actively mastered the lifelong learning skills they need to succeed as 21st century learners, workers, and citizens. How do we know we're doing that well? All these metrics for the niche are what they're doing in school until they graduate. How do we know how well we are preparing them to compete in the 21st century workforce? The landscape for preparing our students is rapidly changing, and public schools must change and create learning environments and opportunities for students to compete, not only in Virginia, but nationally and internationally. We're in what many call the fourth industrial revolution. I didn't know there were four, but there are, and which includes artificial intelligence, machine learning, robotics, nanotechnology, 3D printing, genetics, and biology, which collectively will produce many disruptions and enormous changes in the skill sets that our students need to compete. We are changing how we prepare our students for lifelong success as learners, professionals, and citizens. We're changing how we teach our students, what the curriculum is, and the design and resources of our learning spaces. Estimates are at least half of the job tasks, not the jobs, but the task in jobs, could already be done through artificial intelligence or robotics. It is clear that AI will disrupt not only manufacturing, which it's done for generations, a couple generations at least, but really traditionally safe professions like accounting and medicine and law, which is one of my credentials, is Deloitte is predicting in the next 20 years we will see 100,000 legal roles will be automated. What will that do to law schools? What will that do to who goes into law, and what law looks like. Recently, it was predicted that 1/3 of all the jobs in America could be replaced by software, robots, and smart machines within 10 years. I don't know if that's true, but it's clear that things are happening. And it's not at all clear whether new jobs will sweep in to fill that void. It sort of depends whether you're an AI optimist or a pessimist, and there are people on both sides of that. But you have to remember, even in the first industrial revolution, yes, jobs did emerge after that, but it took 70 years, 70, before we had employment up to what it was before. The Future of Jobs report by the World Economic Forum pointed out that the top 10 jobs in demand in 2010 did not exist in 2004. And remember, the iPhone only came on board in 2007, and I don't know what I did without it. I'm too addicted, I know. But estimates are as many as 65% of elementary students in the U.S. will end up in jobs that have not yet been invented. And they are likely to change their jobs multiple times over their careers. So how do we prepare our students for this? I'd love to have input. The World Economic Forum surveyed 350 executives in 15 industries in 9 of the world's top economies and found that the top 10 skills needed for the 2020 marketplace will be complex. Let me have the slide, Phil. Anyway, the top skills are wrong direction. There we go. Are complex problem solving, critical thinking, creativity, and the next chunk of skills are really people skills, you know, people management, coordinating with others, emotional intelligence, and the like. These are things that AI or robots can't do now. I mean, maybe they will, but right now we're okay. These are the skills that we need to be fostering in our students. Think about this. This is not what our content-driven educations look like. I had my dad as a science teacher 1 year and sat there writing notes and then I memorized them and we had the test. That's not what our students are doing. That's not what they're doing. These skills are very close to what we focus on at ACPS. That is developing learning experiences that empower our students to enhance the 5 C's. And the 5 C's are a subset of these. Creativity, critical thinking, collaboration, communications, service to the community. I believe that we are well positioned to be a state and national leader in the development of an innovative and modern school division, but it'll take some work. To guide us, we have some strategic priority. We can't be a 21st century school division if we're not interested in making sure that all of our students do well and are prepared. That's our legal and our ethical role as a school division. So creating a high culture of expectations for everybody, identifying and removing practices that perpetuate the achievement gap, and ensuring that students identify and develop personal interests. And I'll give you some examples of that as we go along. But the point is, and I probably said it too many times already, but the acquisition of content is not enough. A smartphone has more computing power than the NASA computers that sent the men to the moon. So our students already have content at their fingertips. We at Albemarle County have one-to-one computing from grade 3 to 12, and we have 3-to-2 computing for kindergarten through second grade. What is important is that we teach our students how to access information, how to filter that, how to critically think and evaluate what that information is telling us, how to know what good information is, and how to apply it in problem solving in the real world. If you walk into our classrooms today, you will, those that have been modernized, you will not find desks lined up in rows with students taking notes passive, with a teacher passing on information us doing homework and doing our workbooks. Today's classrooms are designed with flexible tables, students who are seating around the tables, different kinds of seating, different kinds of project areas, interacting with one another. Students are not passively listening to lectures, but they're using their computers to do their own research. They are designing, creating, improving, and building everything from robots to medical devices. I mean, I went to a classroom where they had programmed the 3D printer to do an artificial hand. They'd seen it on TV. But, and these were like middle school students. I mean, I am not worthy. They're writing historical plays and performing it and going to New York to present it. They're going to the White House with their innovations. Dr. Moran, who was our previous superintendent, was an early adopter of P-based learning. P-based learning, what is that? It's been variously called passion-based, project-based, or problem-solving, and whatever it is, it's all the same thing. Unless you get kids interested in it, they're not going to do the other piece. This year, for an example, we had two major award winners at the Piedmont Regional Science Fair. One young student entitled her project, listen to this, Examining Manufactured Esterification, comma, Homemade Esterification, and Non-Corrosive Coating as a Viable Solution to Fatberg Formation. I don't know about you, but when she presented to the school board, I had no idea what her project was about. And I have a PhD in science, and I worked in a science lab. But she went on, the translation is that her research sought to establish a solution to a serious worldwide health and infrastructure problem, the accumulation of fats, oils, and grease that clog sewer systems all over the globe. You don't teach that in your science class. You sort of, they find out about a problem and they dig in and try to fix it. It was a problem that she identified and researched with the guidance of her science teacher who helped her find the information, but she did the work. She had to learn about a variety of subject areas. It showed critical thinking, complex problem solving, and creativity. And developing and presenting her project also honed her community skills. And she was focused on a problem in communities all over the world. This is exactly the kind of teaching that we want to do for all of our students. Our second winner, this one is not quite as hard, but MRI-based hypertrophic cardiomyopathy risk assessment aid using machine learning. Again, what? This student's goal was to develop a medical procedure whereby, these are 16-year-old kids, whereby physicians can better understand, anticipate, and prevent dangers associated with thickening heart muscle. Again, I think her parents are physicians, but I hope so. This student had to learn about cardiology, machine learning, physician behavior, and openness to this sort of assistance. And what both of these projects have in common is fulfilling what we have established as the five C's: collaboration, creative thinking, communication skills. I'm thinking of missing a couple. Critical thinking. These are exemplary, but we have projects all over our schools that look like this. One of the things that we are also pushing, designing our school division to do a better job at is enhancing the connectivity to the community. Because I think the days where the school is over here and the community is over there have to be gone. Both our students and employers value real world experience and problem solving. And these two students knew about these issues and they worked on them, but there's a lot of problems in our communities or challenges or just ideas that our communities and schools could collaborate on. We already have internships through our three STEM academies. Does everybody know what our STEM academies are? We have science, technology, and engineering, and math academy at Albemarle High School. That was our first and our oldest and probably our slightly biggest academy. We have health and medical sciences academy at Monticello High School, and our newest academy is our environmental studies academy at Western High School. But we already have internships if you're a member or if you're going to one of these academies. But in our redesigned curriculum, all juniors and seniors will be required to do a community-based project or internship to gain real-world experiences. To structure these will require significant coordination and participation of community organizations and employers. Here's an example of of one, what one might look like. Internships with UVA Burn Center, and the Surgical Suite of UVA Hand Center, and the Surgery Center at UVA's Orthopedic Clinic. Service in the UVA Emergency Room. Experience with Pegasus, a UVA medevac helicopter. Volunteer hours as an EMT working with the rescue squad. Seminars at the UVA Plastic Surgery Research Lab. That's a record of one of our students. One of our students who's going to be presenting tomorrow night at our school board meeting, and he asked our communications person if he could bring his 84 slides. We said that might be a little bit too many, but as a result of his experience, he's planning to organize a blood drive, and he's arranged for FEMA representatives to visit MH Monticello High School later this year. Through these experiences, this student has honed his critical thinking, problem solving, communication, and collaboration skills, as well as his connections to the community. He's done it all. Another example of how we're supporting student-based problem solving, last year, and this wasn't even part of a forum, this was outside of their normal classes, but last year, a group of students from our three traditional high schools were concerned about the lack of mental health resources in our high school. And as Rich said, this is one area that I'm particularly interested in. And just to give you the baseline, Albemarle High School had one full-time mental health counselor, 2,000 students, and we had a half-time counselor at each of Monticello and Western. They're about 1,100, 1,200 students apiece. They did their research, presented to the school board advocating for more mental health resources. But, you know, they didn't stop there. They developed concrete proposals for increasing staffing, including a segment on mental health and family in the family life curriculum, providing mental health requirements for teacher training, increased state funding for mental health counselors, not only for the obvious health benefit of mental health counselors, but for as part of a more comprehensive school security initiative. Prevention is always better, right? They presented these ideas. They had a forum and invited Cree Deeds, and I was there representing the school board, and to talk about their ideas. He was so impressed, he invited them to present to his mental health commission in Richmond, and they also went the next step. You don't have to go to law school for this. They drafted legislation and presented it, legislation to strengthen the state's mental health curriculum for all school divisions, and they testified in behalf of their proposed bill. It was approved by the General Assembly last year, and the governor signed it. The Albemarle County School Board has not only added mental health counselors, not enough yet, but we added, to the 18-19 budget. And the General Assembly has proposals proposals to help fund those positions. Another, I want to talk a little bit about how the learning environment, the physical place, supports and fosters creativity. Our newest innovation in terms of learning spaces is Albemarle Tech. Albemarle Tech, the full name is Albemarle Tech, Center for Creativity and Innovation. Last year, we rented 40,000 square feet in the Comdial building. I don't know if I had no idea what the Comdial building was, but it's a million square foot facility right adjacent to the Costco, which is now being leased up to a variety of commercial and other concerns. And we took 40,000 square feet. About half of that is for professional development space, our information technology team that are now in trailers and all over the county, as well as our child nutrition folks, but also about half of the space is designed around our students. The student space consists of 9 studios or labs, a library, and a common area. Albemarle Tech is designed to serve as a pilot for how education needs to change. Students work with teachers to design a curriculum around student passions and interests. There are no bells, to signal the end of classes. Students work on their own projects. They earn grades based on an agreement between them and their teacher. I think it's important to point out this first year, we have 22 students. We're starting small. And all of the students are seniors that have already completed all of their requirements. But we plan to grow this to 140, 160 students over the next 3 to 4 years. It's an entirely different high school experience, and what we learn from this program this year will be incorporated into a much larger student center that we plan for 2021. The labs include music, audio, filmmaking, robotics, art, and others that will shift with student interests. I'll give you two examples of the projects. And as I said, it just opened its doors in August, end of August. One student, an Albemarle High School senior, who's also attending K-Tech's firefighting course, applied to AT to learn robotics because he was very interested in developing an aerial robot, otherwise known as a drone, that could monitor the microclimates around wildfires to help give information to firefighters on which way the fire might be going. By his own description, this student was very bored with high school. He'd done his core courses. He was ready to be gone. But he applied to AT. He's there 2 days a week. He's the first one when the doors open to be there and the last one to leave. He's taught himself robotics and is a current winner of the robotic soccer competition. All the students there who wanted to learn robotics, they had a joint task is to develop a robot that could compete in this little tiny soccer field. So he was very proud of that. But we annually, the school board meets with our state legislators. We invite them usually to lunch, usually the county office building. And I said, let's bring them to Albemarle Tech and let them see what our students are doing. And this student who I suspect was not a very outgoing sort, was eloquent. He was so passionate about his experience at Albemarle Tech, about his project. He was chatting it up with Senator Deeds and David Toscano and Steve Landis. He was passionate about what Albemarle Tech permitted him to do. So it was hard not to be impressed with that. Another student, whose passion was imaginative medical drawings and illustration, is completing a book about a child with a rare genetic disease. She worked with the UVA doctor in researching the disease and how patients and their families can maintain the best possible quality of life. She will be providing hospitals and clinics with copies of the book to support patient families. She was recently awarded a presidential scholarship at the highly prestigious Rochester Institute of Technology, and she was also awarded, even more recently than I had known until this morning, a scholarship to VCU. I don't know which one she's going to pick, but she says very plainly that none of this would have been possible without her experience at Albemarle Tech. And as I said, it just opened in August. This is good. So a lot of good things are happening, but of course now we're to the challenges part. We're making progress. That was obviously, maybe not obviously, photographs of some of our students at Albemarle Tech. But we have challenges. Someone asked me at lunch, you know, how diverse is your student body? Our students are from many countries. They were born in 89 different countries. They speak 74 home languages. And this diversity is a wonderful source of enrichment for our schools, but it also poses some challenges. And particularly when you have a 14-year-old student who, in addition to language issues, has educational gaps. You have about a year to catch them up. And that's about close to 10% of our students. About 30% of our students are low income. That is defined as eligible for free and reduced cost lunches by the federal standards. This is pretty high for a community that thinks of itself as quite well off. But it's not evenly distributed, which poses additional challenges. The range is for schools about 10% to 75-ish percent for Greer Elementary, which is in my district. There is a concentration of English language learners, low-income and minority families in the urban ring around Charlottesville. And that is because that's the only place where there's affordable housing, and it's not even that affordable, and the only place where there's some halfway decent transportation. And so we get, we have those students in that urban ring. We also have a surprisingly high number of homeless kids. Our families in crisis served almost 460 homeless children, which includes students and some of their younger siblings. So these kinds of students, require some additional help. We also have, you may have read something a couple months ago about the achievement gap in Charlottesville. It is not limited to Charlottesville. We have large difference in the performance of our students in standardized tests, if you're black or white, or if you're low income or higher income, Latino. We also, troubling, is there's differences in the percentage of students referred to discipline who are identified as gifted, much lower if you're black or Latino or low income. We're really scrutinizing how we identify kids as gifted and whether that's a good idea to start plucking kids in first grade as gifted, particularly when we have such a diverse student body. So we're addressing this in many ways. I'm running long, so we have also, over the past 6 months, invited a student group to work with us to develop an anti-racism policy. These were student volunteers from our student leadership academy this summer, and they were extraordinary in how focused, how much hard work they did on this. They looked at what other school divisions had such policies, almost none. They looked at definitions of racism, whether it's individual racism, whether it's institutional racism, whether it's structural racism. They looked at practices that might seem neutral, like identifying kids as gifted, that have disproportionate adverse impacts. And they have crafted a policy. I think we saw version 6, but it's, or maybe it's version 8, because they've asked for a lot of input. I have every expectation that the school board will review, refine, and pass something in the next couple of months. It's really an important issue. We hear from our students about a lot of things, and I can answer questions about it. But I think it's going to be an important linchpin in how we move forward. And not surprisingly, we're an educational enterprise, and these kids are being educated. A key part of their anti-racism policy was education, not just of them or teachers, but our bus drivers, every single person, and school board members, everybody, that we need to get a greater sensitivity to this. Another challenge is recruiting teachers. Last year, Virginia had about 1,000 openings for teachers that they couldn't fill. And we are seeing a huge decline nationally in the numbers of people going into education. If you're going to go to UVA and spend what you spend on tuition, are you going to come out and get a $40,000 job as a teacher? Or are you going to, especially if you're science and math? I mean, there's lots of places you can go. We have not had positions unfilled. But we did see, we've usually had about 1,200 applications for 150, 180 jobs. And we had about 800 for about 180 jobs. So it's down. The numbers are down, and they're troubling. We're still a good place. I mean, we counteract that to some degree because we're recognized as a top performing school division, but we can't be blind to that challenge. High school redesign, you may have heard, when are we going to get a new high school? And we can talk about that. What we did is I mean, I initially, 2 years ago, started with the idea that, of course, we're going to build a new high school, and we're going to build it up 29. We spent a year with a consultant, and we started looking at what modern learning spaces look like, and also looking at how old our other schools are. I mean, Albemarle High School was built in 53. So are we going to have one shining new high school, full tilt high school up 29, and, you know, old ones? And we really thought that a better approach would be to build a dynamic high school center that all of our 4,000 high school students could use, have it more centrally. Well, actually, the initial plan and 5 years out might be two centers, but not build a full-fledged high school. Do two things. Redesign the learning spaces at our four existing high schools. This is the project over the next 5 years. To make it support education better, build a high school center somewhere closer in the core area that up to 600 students could go to for parts of a day, or something like Albemarle Tech, a couple days a week. It would be closer and more permeable to the community, to employers, and we could do all of that for about two-thirds the cost of a new high school, which we, you know, a new high school is about $120 million. A new center, we our estimates were, if we only needed one high school center, and that would depend on the growth, we could, for about $80-85 million over the next 5 years, could build a student center, modernize all of our other high schools, and not have to redistrict. It would be more equitable for all of our students, and every student in high school would be touched with the new learning environment. Finally, I know you're delighted for that. My hope is that we really can foster greater community connections. One element of that you may want to take advantage of is we offer a gold card that's offered free to seniors and permits you to go to any school event, play, concert, athletic event for nothing. And I urge you to do that. But I also urge you to be like Rich and actively be a part of our schools, whether it's working with division folks or school board, coming and seeing what our students can do, walking the schools. And if you can think of projects, a walking path at the new senior center, our students who die would love to be able to help you design that. And that's the kind of interaction we want to have. We want to have these student centers permeable to the public, so there's an exchange back and forth. With that, I'll stop.
Thank you very much. This is fantastic. Let me open it for questions and wait for the microphone to come by. Let's see where it's going. Okay, we're going to the back and then the front. Put it like this.
More homogeneous racially. I haven't seen the data, but I wonder if, to the extent that's correct, how we're approaching that, or what are the causal factors?
Are we here? Oh, sorry. I'm not exactly sure what you mean by homogeneous. What we... Well... That's, as I mentioned before, our urban ring, which is defined as a 35 square miles, the 35 square mile donut around the city, that's our most diverse area. And it's about 56% of our county population, and it is the most diverse. And one of the issues, my conclusion, without hard data, is that that's where the housing is. That's where some, I mean, we see a lot of moving back and forth of families from the city to the county. You know, they go back and forth actually quite a bit. But it's because we have some available housing and some transportation. It's much, a few years ago when we were looking at redistricting, we thought, well, we could maybe send some kids from Greer to Murray Elementary School. There was no way the families could get there. No way. And we even looked at Ubering, and we decided that probably wasn't a great idea. But we are limited by the transportation grid. And also, I think down in, and my colleagues on the Board of Supervisors don't like me concluding this, but I think in that whole southern feeder pattern, Monticello down to Scottsville, there's not a lot of development or jobs down there, and there's no transportation. So that, whatever it is, it stays that way. So I don't know what the answer, what can we do about it? I don't know. Unless you purposely redistrict to distribute the kids, I don't know what we can do. I mean, I think what we have to do as a community, and we've been talking with the Board of Supervisors quite a bit, we need more affordable housing, not only for these families, but our teachers, our police officers. They're relatively low income in terms of the average house prices in this county. We need to be talking about transportation. We need to do a better job. And we're actually thinking through, given that we have 200 buses, how could we help the transportation issues in the county? And we're not where we need to be on that conversation, but I think it's one we might want to have.
There's a question up here in front, and I'll come back.
Thanks, John. Kate, my impression is, and you know, maybe I'm wrong, but the boards have to meet in public, and there have been issues that have come up that make it difficult for you to make rational and decisions. And how tough is that in terms of you doing your job as a board, and what are your recommendations going forward on addressing that?
You are correct in that we've had some rather disruptive folks either attending our meetings or making public comment, and that has been going on for 11 months. We, after an August meeting when I had to gavel the meeting out, you know, adjourned, we met with security folks as well as the Commonwealth's attorney saying, what are the rules? What can we do? Because we don't have an obligation to have public comment. There's no obligation to do it. There is an obligation in the code if you're redistricting, if you are closing a school, you have an obligation to have a public hearing. But otherwise, we do it because we actually want to hear from people. Not necessarily the same people, the same thing every week, but we really want to do that. And I have been, we have worked very hard to maintain order because we can't, it's not good for anybody not to have those meetings. But you're right, we're obligated to meet in the daylight. I mean, we can't squirrel away someplace and do our work as much as I would like to sometimes. But we have not had those kinds of disruptions since August, September. Not to say that there hasn't been some harsh words, but we've not had to stop a meeting. But it is a challenge to have meetings. We have carved out times. I mean, all of our, under Virginia code, you know, we have to have open meetings, and we do, except if we have professional development, and even our retreats are open. I mean, almost nobody comes. We have a few reporters, but we do our work in public, and I think that's the way it should be, but some people do make it harder. I am the chair probably until tomorrow night. Every year by Virginia, I've been chair for 3 years, which is unusual. I have to say, I bullied my way for my third year because it's usually 1 or 2 years. But every year by code, you elect new officers, and your first meeting is an organizational meeting, and there will be a new chair. So my sincere hope is that maintaining order is a high priority going forward as well, because it's a waste of everybody's time.
I'm Clarice Edson. I'm a retired teacher, and I taught for 26 years at Albemarle High School. About 10 days ago, I wrote an article to the newspaper, and it was published on the editorial page. Did you read that?
I have not seen it, no.
Okay.
I've been moving this past 2 weeks. I'm sorry.
Okay. Well, I'd like to read it to you. It's not very long, but this is what I wrote. Since 1976, when I first moved to Charlottesville, I have felt the need to express my opinion in the Daily Progress only once before. Now I have reached the point where I need to speak up for the second time. I am absolutely appalled over the science classes at Albemarle High School. I taught in that same school for 26 years. And the thought of tearing down walls to make bigger classes and more distractions for teachers and students to cope with is absolutely ridiculous. We all know that in order to learn, one must pay attention and be focused. How can anyone focus when there are distractions everywhere? Furthermore, the article in the Daily Progress the Sunday before said that the problem came from oversight in professional development. Therefore, teachers will be trained in a one-day session. That's ridiculous. If the division officials had consulted the teachers before the walls were removed, the teachers would have told the experts that this was a terrible plan. Think of all the wasted taxpayer money that went into removing those walls. And now teachers are forced to cope by using removable partitions. That's unbelievable. Even more unbelievable is that the teachers are being made the scapegoats for the division leaders' poor decisions. Why don't we have division officials who are good teachers and know the score on what works and what doesn't? Instead, we have administrators who jump on the latest bandwagon and pour money into the latest trend. Doesn't anyone remember that open classrooms were tried once before, decades ago? And they fail then, too. My biggest regret is that my grandchild is now trapped in one of these terrible science classes, learning nothing, and there's not a single thing that I can do to help her. Please, parents, get involved and stop this. So here's my question for you. Why were the walls removed? How many teachers were consulted before this was done? And how long before the school system will be asking for money to put those walls back up?
I don't know all the answers to that. I was just at one of the new science labs that we did with the referendum funding, and the teachers we talked to three, loved the room. I think there's a lot of confusion about open classrooms and what these labs are. There's no reduction in the numbers of teachers, and in fact, there's more per student. When you're doing project-based learning, you need a lot of different stations and a larger space and more differentiated kinds of seatings and tables. Lab benches work better. One of the teachers was very specific that it permitted her to address the needs of individual students and maybe group them differently because she had more space. This was I did not go to the chemistry or the biology labs. I went to the earth science and environmental lab. They were very enthusiastic about the space. Of course, you know, they're talking to the chair of the school board. Maybe they would be. I get that. But when I was, I mean, as my dad was a science teacher too, and I've often thought about how he would like these changes. But he was an early proponent of project-based learning, which is not kids lined up in a row and actively doing projects. We are not reproducing the problems of open classrooms. If you go, I mean, when we built the addition at Agner Hurt Elementary School, I think it opened in 2015, there were a lot, there's the new areas, about 10,500 square feet, had different areas, and I invite you to go see it. I'll meet you there and show you. And initially, the parents and the teachers were very, very fearful of what this would do. And as it turned out, because there was the old school and then the new addition, the old school still had traditional classrooms. And the new area had all these open but very differentiated areas. There's now a waiting list there to get the kids in that kind of space. The kids are much more engaged. The teachers can differentiate the learning better than if you just have a static classroom. No doubt there will be bumps, and we have heard from other teachers who want more consultation, and I think that's fair. I think that's a fair critique. But I don't think just saying these are like the open classrooms of 40 years ago is apt to what we're doing now.
My understanding is that the best predictor for educational success is the primary family. And as an educator, former educator, retired, I just wondered if you can comment if teachers are getting professional development about how to interact with families.
That's an excellent question. I'm not entirely sure I know the answer. We do have community outreach people on staff. I know I have met with, we've had some, my colleague, my vice chair, and I have invited community members, say at Greer, in that community, which is a lot of international, very diverse population, just to see, you know, what their concerns are. We are focusing, I mean, as Rich will tell you, one of the things that got slashed big time during the recession was professional development, and I have worked, about 70% of it was cut at the worst, and teachers were okay with that because they thought it would just be a couple of years, and then suddenly it's 10. So we've been working very hard to restore professional development money, but we've also worked very hard to deploy those funds wisely in asking, providing micro-credentialing for students who, for teachers who study areas like social-emotional development of our kids, or who are studying how best to address the achievement gaps. So we are trying to utilize those funds so they will have evidence-based training that they have to demonstrate they apply in the classroom. So we're trying to tighten that up. You don't go for a weekend and listen to a couple lectures. We want this to be directly applicable and monitored application. But we can do better. I'm sure we can. I mean, one of the things that we did, I guess a year and a half ago, we began a pilot called a seed, well, it included a seed team, but it was really, it stood for a group of psychologists, social workers, to work with the Urban Ring Elementary Schools, and seed was a social, emotional, and academic development, and really focus in supporting the teachers, but but also helping the principal deal with a lot of the issues that a lot of these kids bring in. We're working on it, but get involved. Yeah, you can be an advisor on this. It'd be great.
That's great. Kate, you talked about the school being in the top 3%, and I'll come over, top 3% of the state. And I wondered if the innovation is getting ahead of the state, and I'm thinking about the fact that you talked about collaboration, cognitive flexibility, creativity, critical thinking, and complex problem solving. How does that square with the state's traditional SOL approach of here's the question and here are the five possible answers?
Excellent question, hard one. One of the things that's very troubling to me about, well, first of all, our average SOL scores are great. I mean, they are good. What is troubling to me is that our SOL scores for blacks, Latinos, low income stink. I mean, they're not very good. They can they're clearly great kids, smart kids in all of these categories, but I think one of the things we have talked about in the past few months is that perhaps whether or not we think the SOLs are fabulous, and we don't, students are still measured by them. Right. And you can't ignore those basics in favor of a totally, you know, project-based. You have to do both. And I think we veered a little bit too much, and some of the school divisions that do better than we do with these groups teach the curriculum, and we need to make sure that happens at the same time we do the other. You put the
challenge. I wonder if the state's holding us back. There was a question up here in the front.
In relation to closing the achievement gap, what is the, how does the diversity of teachers match the diversity of the students, and what organized ways are there being done for engaging persons from parents and community leaders from minority groups in the ongoing planning process?
That's a great question. We work really hard. Well, I think we have about 14% minority teachers. We've got about 11% black students and 13% Latino. That's as far as my head can handle. We work really hard to recruit minority teachers. We support the African American Teaching Fellows Program. Start recruiting and hiring early to try to get ahead of the curve. We go to traditional black colleges. We need to do more. My sense is that there may be more turnover, so we're constantly working on that. But having our teaching staff look like the students is important. We're also looking, I mean, the actual teacher hires are done at the building, at the school level. So we're also looking at the hiring practices of individual principals. You know, are you ever picking an African-American teacher? I don't know. I mean, we're looking at that so we don't just have our African-American teachers at Albemarle High School or something, that we have a greater distribution across the county. But it's an ongoing annual process. I mean, we have our human resources people out recruiting now. Oh, yeah. I mean, probably already.
So the second part of my question.
Oh, I'm sorry. I got carried away.
Was in what ways are community leaders from the minority neighborhoods and parents from the minority neighborhoods involved in an ongoing way in the planning process of the school district?
Probably not enough. I mean, as I said, we do try to have outreach events, but we don't have enough interaction in that area, for sure.
But isn't one of your innovations for this year to more community outreach?
Right. Community outreach. We do a really, really good job. I mean, like South, what's it called?
Southwood.
Yeah. We do a good job in outreach there, but that's a more organized community to begin with. And we do have people, but it's more difficult. I mean, for example, I haven't gone lately, but State of the Greer PTO meetings. And there's not, even though that's one of the most diverse schools in the county, it's not a diverse PTO. I mean, it just isn't. And I don't know if income is a variable there. You know, multiple jobs. You know, meeting at 9 o'clock in the morning is a toughie for a lot of people. So that is an area that we need to explore more. So if you've got ideas.
There was a question in the back, and then I'll come over.
Hi, Dave.
Hi, Kate. I wonder to what extent you think our concern for some of these, or our push for new initiatives and concern for new problems and challenges are still somehow connected to a couple of old-fashioned, very old-fashioned factors. One being classroom size, pupil-teacher ratios. I was always struck when I was a teacher years ago and when I was a student in the 1960s that those five C's were taught often, but they were more often taught in the classrooms where the teacher had the opportunity to individualize the instruction and teach in a smaller classroom, and they weren't, you know, hurting people all the time. And of course, when I taught at the university level, it becomes very clear when you move from secondary school to higher ed that you have to lecture when you've got 180 students in your classroom, and you can't really individualize it except for outside the classroom. The other one that strikes me as a consistently important factor that's been around for a long time is not so much teacher recruiting, which, you know, when I was in South Louisiana, a place where they don't have top 200 schools, you know, in the nation. They're, you know, they're a far cry from that. We didn't have as much of a problem with recruiting, but we had a big problem with retention. And I wonder if that's not still the big factor there.
Two totally different questions. We have really good relatively small classroom sizes. Our classroom sizes for elementary are 19 to 20, and maybe 20 to 21 in middle. And these are averages. I mean, you can have 30 people in your English, you know, core course in high school. But we have managed to keep our class sizes small. And consistently, when we do surveys of our parents, that's what they value. And some of our schools in the urban ring that are Title I schools, because they have a high percentage of low-income kids, have even a smaller ratio. I mean, maybe 18 kids in a classroom. And they have teacher aides, and they have reading specialists. They may have ESOL teachers. They may have special ed teachers. And so there's a lot of teaching resources. So I feel good about our class sizes. We've really worked hard to keep them small. Tell me what you said the other one.
Retention.
The retention. Yeah, I think we're in steady state. I mean, we've asked that over, you know, each year we get a human resources report. We don't see a big drain. But I was surprised. This is the most teachers we had hired in a long time. When I've been on the school board for 5 years, and we were hiring 120 or so, and we had 180 this year. Part of it was growth, but part of it was turnover. We really expected to see a big bolus of retirements a few years ago when they changed the VRS rules, but we didn't. We have a lot of new teachers, and we have not had that problem. But it concerns me that we've historically had, my short history of 5 years, 1,200 applicants for 150 jobs, and we had 820-ish for 180 jobs. That's not the right direction.
And the VRS is the Virginia Retirement System,
right.
And what they require the teachers to contribute to their own
right.
retirement.
So a lot of teachers stayed on in order to get that extra, and we thought, okay, they're going to stay for 3 years when they vest, and then they would retire, and they didn't.
Right. There's a question over there.
I'd like to thank you for your presentation and also for your service to this community. It's obviously rather overwhelming to most of us. One thing I would like to comment on is meetings are held. You're looking at a bunch of people here, some of whom don't drive at night.
Hmm.
So not only do you have the problem of people coming to things in the morning because they have to do something else, but you have that issue too. And I don't know that there's a solution to that, but do you stream the school board meetings? I pay a lot of attention to the county board meetings.
Yeah.
That way, if I can't go in the daytime.
I have to say we're sort of changing that. We do podcasts.
Okay.
We have not filmed and streamed, but
okay.
We're talking about doing that.
Okay. I just, again, want to thank you very much. I think you have a big job, and we're talking about the 3, 4, 5, or 6, or 7 C's. Teachers are asked to teach much more than that.
Oh,
they're
yeah.
They're asked to teach the discipline that parents do not and the respect. So I think we ask an awful lot of our teachers.
Our teachers, our bus drivers, the first face of the school district that the kids see is the bus driver. And, you know, we really do professional development of our drivers, too, and how to handle those situations. Maybe where the parents haven't done the best job.
So we have time for one more question, but I'll do a follow-up. But Berta, and then over to Virginia.
Thank you again so much for coming. And I'm so glad, too, that you're thinking of reuse of the present buildings. My children went to a school that was built in 1776. It's
oh, I can't impress you.
As far as I know, Moses Brown was the name of the school in Providence, but I think Brown's been around a little while.
Yeah.
I think maybe Harvard's been around a little while. Yale's been around a little while. They've had to add to them, but they are still reusing those same old buildings. And I think that's terrific.
Thank you.
I mean, I think in looking at our renting and building out of the space at the Comdial building, you may see us doing more things like that. It's an innovative way to go about it for our district. It gets our students closer to employers and possible internships. It's an interesting way to go. I think a lot of the spaces may need to be restructured a bit, but Albemarle High School, and I know our teacher friend over here knows that, has a little tiny cafeteria sort of in the middle of the building. We now are over capacity. We've got 200 students in trailers behind the school. The cafeteria is so small we have to have 4 lunch periods. Well, that sounds okay, except we know that teenage brains like to wake up a little bit later, so our students come in later, and the first lunch period is at 10:30 because we have to have 4 of them, which seems crazy to me. But anyway, that's off topic. But
good.
I have... Oh,
no,
sorry.
That's a good point.
Yeah. I just wanted to add another thing about diversity. There's the male-female diversity thing, too. We have not gotten that many males into teaching, Yes, I know it has to do with pay. But if we're sending all these women someplace else, why don't we grab a few men and throw them in?
I think that's a good point. And I'm always asking our diversity in our academies. Are we seeing how many girls are in our Mesa Academy versus boys? Amazingly, we do pretty well. But I'm always asking that question. I think that's a great one.
Excellent one. I want to really thank you, Kate, for a fantastic presentation.
Was there one more? Did you have one?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Are you the STEM questioner?
I missed it. All right. I didn't see it. Jean Ecton, here's the microphone right behind you. Right behind you.
Thank you. Well, first of all, I want to let you know that the African American Teaching Fellows was started by a senior statesman of Virginia member, John Baker, who was chairman of the school board. And it is continued by his widow, Marie Baker, and also another member of Senior Statesman Virginia and the African American Teaching Fellows is Madison Cummings, who is also a member of the Albemarle County School Board. So we do have a connection in that area. My question was about the STEM academies, and also you brought up something about a leadership program in the summer. Who qualifies for that?
I have no idea on that one. I mean, I know we had a leadership academy last summer and that these students worked on the anti-racism committee, but I have to confess I don't know that answer. But you and I had talked a minute at the outset about the STEM academies. One of the things that we're doing to, well, the STEM academies are the science academies at the three high schools. And although our policy has always been any student, any high school eighth grader, actually, you apply to go to an academy. Any student can go to any of the academies, whether it's at your school or not. But as I talked to you about 200 buses, 726 square miles, we didn't provide transportation. And so maybe if you applied to Mesa and you lived in Crozet, your parents were going to town. But if you're at Hollymead, your parents aren't going to West or Crozet. I mean, they're not. And so this year, for the first time, as part of our efforts to address the achievement gap and equity across our whole division, we've provided transportation. And we saw, I think it's a 40% increase in the applications to go to an out-of-school academy. I mean, it's not much, but we're working on it.
Again, I want to thank you for a great presentation, helping us learn more about the Albemarle schools and also encouraging volunteers from this group, and that would be fantastic. But thank you.
Thank you for having me.